Now on 198 Longwave and DAB Digital Radio, it's time for the Act of Worship, led by the Reverend Dr. Michael Ford. Now on Radio 4 FM, our Book of the Week, Last Man Off by Matt Lewis. The Sudahavid has gone down, leaving the crew floating in life rafts in the middle of the icy Southern Ocean.
Saturday the 6th of June, 1998. I waited for morning, for rescue, for relief. Bubbles' roll calls had wakened me from my stupor several times, but the interval was growing and the cold was tightening its grip on me. Mornay and I tried one more time to thread the strap through the plastic eyelet to fasten the canopy down. The task was more difficult now, but it was more crucial than ever. We had to preserve the little heat we had left if we were to survive. Blessedly, it gave my mind a focus, something I could achieve, something to stop me from dying. My frozen fingers worked to grip the strap like chopsticks, forcing it by sheer willpower through the eyelet. But my efforts only lasted seconds. The cover was ripped back from my fingers by the wind, and once again the cold air blasted in and I shrank back. I tried to grab the flailing canvas, but my arms were too slow. And then there was a red light. Was I imagining things? While the cogs of my mind clunked slowly, the swells moved again and a wave dropped from our view, revealing again the image I had seen. A red light. And now a row of white lights below. It was the side of a boat. 100 meters away, aglow with glorious illuminated bulbs. Lights, I called out. I can see lights. I think... Saturday the 6th of June, 1998. On the bridge of the Isla Camilla, Captain Ernesto Sandoval heard Bubbles Mayday and wrote on the whiteboard, Barco Abandonar, and noted down the coordinates. Of all of the boats in the Southern Ocean, the Chilean vessel Isla Camilla was the closest to the Sudahavid's last position, but she was still 33 miles away. For the next 3 hours, the crew of the Isla Camilla pushed the boat as hard as they dared, crashing through the furious seas. The journey to the stricken vessel's last reported position should take 3.5 hours, and they plotted where they would begin the hunt. The Chilean fishermen changed into thick layers of jumpers, coats, hats and gloves and put their oilskins and boots back on to keep the freezing wind and spray at bay. Factoring in the wind chill, they could expect minus 15 degrees on deck. They knew the search could take hours and could expect to be outside the entire time, directing spotlights and peering into the darkness. Captain Sandoval watched the sea as they arrived at the Sudahavid's last reported position, hoping that some wreckage would appear in the floodlights. The beams of the searchlights reached out into the night, but it was only possible to see a few hundred meters on either side of the boat, and the crew had to scan slowly. The swells rose and blocked the lights, then dropped suddenly to reveal an entirely new vista. A whole ship could be hidden in the trough of a swell, let alone a life raft. 30 minutes into the search, and more than 4 miles from the last known position of the Sudahavid, one of the deck crew at the rail started waving his arms frantically. He had glimpsed a flashing light. Suddenly, amidst all the grey water and white foam, they picked out the fluorescent orange roof of a life raft. The Isla Camilla was a scene of pandemonium. Out on deck, the crew were yelling instructions and requests, whilst the men of the raft were calling for help. One by one, the men were seized by their clothing or a rope was looped under their shoulders and they were hauled on board. Amidst all the confusion, another cry rang out. One of the deck crew at the railing had spotted something. A flash of silver reflective tape, caught in the beam of a searchlight. It was another life raft. With no lights, it was barely visible through the waves and the spray. After 3.5 hours of drifting and ocean bombardment, the two rafts were separated by just 70, maybe 100 metres. Along the side of the Isla Camilla, I could see crews spread out along the deck rail and in the fishing pit in vivid yellow and orange oilskins. Silhouetted by a halo of light, their faces were hidden in hoods, but I could hear their voices. Driven closer on a rising wave, the crew threw a white rope towards us, which landed with a slap across the roof. I knelt up and stretched to grasp it, but I was too slow. It slid into the water. The second throw tangled on my stiff, splayed fingers. I tried to hold on so that they could pull us in. If we could get alongside, we would all be able to board safely. After a few more hopeless attempts at grasping the rope being thrown to me, I gave up trying. I held out my stiff arms like a child reaching up for a parent's embrace. If I couldn't hold on to their ropes, they could hold on to me. In the mad rush of the rescue, there was no time for tenderness. I was lifted under the shoulders by two crewmen and dragged through the corridors into a cold storeroom. All 14 of the men who were in the first raft had survived and were sat around me now, huddled on the benches at three or four different tables. One by one, the rest of the survivors from the second raft, my raft, were brought into the canteen. Big Dani, Bjorgvin, Mornay, Brian, Eugene, and Hannes. There was no celebration or cheer. Barely even a greeting broke the silence. My mental arithmetic wasn't at full speed, but I knew that there had been more people in my raft than were being brought into the mess. Brian was one of the last to be saved and was carried into the room. "They're taking bodies off the raft," he slurred. When the third raft was found later, it was empty. Late that night, as the adrenaline faded and exhaustion set in, we were offered the chance of a few hours' kip in a bunk. I slipped under the rough woolen blankets and pulled them around my shoulders. The warmth generated by my chilled core was slowly building, and I drifted off to sleep. 1300 hours. Monday the 8th of June, 1998. We were a ragged bunch disembarking in the sheltered waters off King Edward Point, South Georgia. Gordon Liddell, the Scottish harbour master, didn't really want 21 unexpected guests in the middle of winter or their medical problems, but he dutifully welcomed us. The arrangements for the next stage of our journey home were confirmed. The tanker Gold Rover was the only available vessel big enough to carry us all to the Falkland Islands. Sailing west, we crossed the Antarctic Convergence, leaving the frigid Antarctic waters behind us. We stayed at the British Antarctic Survey's hostel, just a few streets from the harbour side in Stanley. The Falkland Islanders showed us the warm hospitality so often seen in remote places, and we soon found the Globe Tavern. We would be regulars for the next 5 days. Bringing the bodies ashore in the Falkland Islands triggered the involvement of the island's coroner, which meant a police interview for each of us, and then a coroner's inquiry. The inquest took place in the town hall. The spacious formal council room gave proceedings a reassuring authority. We were asked to read out our evidence, and the coroner asked a few questions, but there were no grand accusations or scandalous verdicts. After 3 days of evidence, the formalities came to a close and we were told we were free to leave. Almost 2 weeks had passed since the Suda Harvard had sunk, and we all just wanted to see our families. The Isla Camilla appeared at anchor in the inlet just off Stanley while we were attending the inquest. Captain Sandoval had been unable to bring us directly to the Falklands, but had been forced to make the trip to pick up a new observer. On our last night in Stanley, we were out once again at the Globe Tavern. It was busy and loud, and I had my hand around a pint of beer when a Chilean man came across and started trying to talk to me. He clearly had something important he wanted to say, but my Spanish was worse than his English. Thankfully, a woman nearby offered to step in and act as a translator for us both. Jesus Posada, one of the Isla Camilla's crew, had something to ask me. He says, "Do you remember me?" "Of course I remember you, from the Isla Camilla. He looked disappointed. I must have given the wrong answer. Do you remember it was me who pulled you onto the boat? The moment was such a blur and I was almost unconscious. I tried to explain. I cannot remember faces, only hands grabbing me and falling down on the deck. It was me. I grabbed you with my friend and we pulled you. We stood you on your feet. And then I kissed you on your cheek and said, "Thank you, God." I had been thinking about how much we owed the Isla Camilla all week. Giving evidence to the police and the coroner's inquest had made it crystal clear just how lucky we were to be alive and how much we owed Captain Sandoval and his crew. I fought to find the right words through the haze of a few too many pints of beer. "We won't forget what you did for us that night, you know." It was inadequate, but after a pause for translation, he nodded. If I was to make a gesture, it was now or never. I would probably never see Jesus or any of his crewmates again. "When I have children, one day, if one is a girl, I will call her Camilla, to remind me of what you all did for us." "1604, Friday, 6th of June, 2008. I'm standing, ankle deep, in cold grey seawater, on a beach just north of Aberdeen. I have an ice-cold Castle beer in each hand. The cream and red labels proudly declare the contents to be the great South African beer. Dog walkers wander behind me on the golden sand. I can feel their stares. Their dogs bound down towards me, and I hope their owners don't follow. This is my private ceremony. No one joins or witnesses it, but this year will be my last. It is 10 years since the sinking. Time to move on. Gazing out at the clouds on the horizon, feeling self-conscious, I speak out loud. I hope the wind will carry my words out to sea, to be heard. This is for you, boys. I haven't forgotten you. Taking a swig from the bottle in my right hand, I pour a mouthful of the second beer into the water around my feet. Their real memorial, not of stone or wood, but of salt water, flows around my feet and mixes with the amber castle. Tuesday, the 28th of July, 2009. It's a mad sprint from our house to the maternity unit at Aberdeen Royal Infirmary. Our two-year-old son, Tate, is with our neighbour. Corinne leans heavily on my arm as we are led through to the labour ward. The delivery room is light and airy, the summer sun brightening the blinds. The midwife starts to run through the paperwork, but it all happens so fast. Within 20 minutes, Corinne is giving birth. When the midwife cradles the baby in her hands, Corinne asks, "Is it a boy or a girl?" "It's a girl." Corinne wipes the blonde hair back from her face and smiles with joy and relief. The new arrival cries. "Does she have a name?" the midwife asks. "She does. Camilla." I've been waiting 11 years to say this and to write her name. Camilla, one L, like the boat.
Last Man Off was written by Matt Lewis, abridged by Pete Nichols, and read by Sam Troughton. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4.
World War I had a huge impact on the formation of the Commonwealth, and the drive for its formation came not from the British end, but from the kith and kin colonies.
As the Commonwealth Games approach, BBC Radio 4 looks at the history of the Commonwealth of Nations.
There's no way in which we can or even should divorce the history of British imperialism from the present Commonwealth.
It was reactionary in the first instance, but it became enlightened.
The Paper Commonwealth, on Monday morning at 11 o'clock.